Okay.
Let's see, what is your first name?
Rhett.
Rhett, okay.
R-H-E-T-T.
Oh, Rhett, okay.
Yeah. Turner. Bill Anders, this is going to be your first trip into space. I presume you're more excited than the two old-timers, Borman and Lovell.
I really am eagerly looking forward to the experience. I think it'll be a wonderful trip.
Tell us a bit about yourself and your flying background.
Well, I was... let me think about that a minute. How far do you
okay,
want
to go ahead. Go, or where are you from? Okay. Where are you from in the United States?
Well, I'm from San Diego, California, and graduated from the Naval Academy, went to the Air Force, learned to fly.
A Navy man who went to the Air Force.
Right, and was flying at Albuquerque, New Mexico, when I was selected for this program.
When did you come into the astronaut program?
In early 1964.
Mm-hmm. Is your wife a San Diego girl?
Yes, she's a hometown girl, too.
You knew her back when you were growing up, I bet.
No, I didn't know her until after college, and it turned out we'd lived a block away from each other, but had never really gotten acquainted until we were both older.
Well, how could a Navy Academy man go on to the Air Force?
Well, in the days when I graduated, the Air Force Academy hadn't gotten going yet, so 25% of West Point and the Naval Academy were commissioned into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been here in Houston now in the astronaut program?
Since 1964, and make it about a little over 4 years.
Uh-huh. And your home is here now, and your family's growing up here?
Yes, we live in a nearby community. Everybody's well ensconced as a local residence.
How about your children? How many children you have?
I have five children, two boys, a girl, and two boys.
Oh, boy. What ages?
The oldest is 11, and they sort of equally spaced right on down to 4.
And what do they think of Daddy being an astronaut?
Well, they're interested in the space program, but since they go to school with so many other kids whose daddies are astronauts, why, it's no big deal. And if you ask one of them what he wants to be when he grows up, he'll probably tell you a fireman or a policeman.
Rather than an astronaut? Are they going to miss you at Christmas time there, or are you going to have your own Christmas another time
later?
We'll
have our Christmas a little early, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, they're going to be out of school, and they'll be wondering where Dad is.
Mm-hmm. Well, they'll be watching him on television every
certainly
night.
I would imagine so. Yeah. We can squeeze it in among the cartoons.
Yeah. You planning to send a little greeting of some sort back to the family, I hope?
Probably will, though I haven't worked out the details of
it. Bill, okay, let me wrap that one up. I'm going to put a thank you on it. Thanks very much, Bill Anders. Now, Bill, you are called the Lunar Module Pilot, but really on this particular flight, without a LEM or Lunar Module, you'll be a systems engineer of sorts, won't you?
That's right. Prior to the time we changed our mission to the lunar flight, I was involved with the LEM-4 and learning all the systems in that vehicle. When the decision was made to just go with a command module, then my job became that of a systems expert to supply the electricity and the cooling and air conditioning and to make sure the vehicle hung together.
You're looking right at a switch panel full of all those controls,
right,
aren't you?
They're all wiggling out at me, and of course in lunar orbit one of my main jobs will be photography,
mm-hmm.
to keep the cameras going and the film straight and exposures proper, and also to try to make just eyeball observations of what we might see on the lunar surface that might be of scientific interest.
Mm-hmm. During the first hours of the flight, during Earth orbit, and then right after the translunar burn, will that be the most crucial time of your systems watching?
Well, certainly any time in lunar orbit we'll be exceptionally aware of all the system situations. But I think the biggest test of the systems comes just prior to insertion out of Earth orbit,
mm-hmm.
Towards the moon, where we're going to insist that all the spacecraft systems be in almost perfect working order, or mm-hmm. else we'll just stay in Earth orbit.
Time you'll be going down across the South Pacific and across
yes.
Australia waiting for that go,
yes.
no go.
Yes, across the first 1.5 revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And the next serious hurdle that the systems have to cross are the examination we'll give them prior to insertion into lunar orbit. Again, they have to be in fine working order, or we'll fly around behind the moon and come back on the other side on our way back to Earth.
You will have had a couple of days to get them ready by
yes,
then.
A couple of days to really get a good feel for them. And again, unless they are in almost perfect working order, we will probably not go into lunar orbit.
Do you feel good about the redundancy of those systems that you'll be watching?
Yes, the vehicle has been very well designed and built and has a tremendous amount of capability, and I feel quite confident in it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about some of the systems now. We've been mentioning the word. Now let's talk about the specifics.
Well, the ones that I'm primarily concerned with would be the environmental control system, the air conditioning, cooling, air revitalization system, which removes the carbon dioxide from the air, takes the solar and body heat from the oxygen cooling gas, and also maintains the cooling for the various electronic components. This, of course, is a critical system, and but it does have a redundant backup system,
mm-hmm.
and we feel that either one could get us back from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Another, probably the most critical system is the electrical power system. We have three fuel cells, devices which convert hydrogen and oxygen into electricity and water. We drink the water, use it in our water boilers to cool us, and of course use electricity to power the spacecraft systems direct current and alternating current.
Mm-hmm. The systems engineer.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Bill. We're on. The level's better now?
No, you got a good balance.
Okay. Bill, I've heard a lot about your preparations for the things you'll be doing during this 21-hour lunar orbit period. I think you're going to come out as a master photographer after this mission, aren't you?
Well, at least I'll push the shutter a lot of times.
All right. What will you be taking pictures of and why?
Well, we're going to have one major photographic task, which will be to try to get a better knowledge of the various locations of features on the surface of the moon, to find out exactly where they are. Our Lunar Orbiter program did a fine job in pinning down locations on the front side of the moon. We got some very good pictures of the back side, but there is some uncertainty as the exact location of where these features might be, and this, of course, is important for lunar landing flights in the future. They must be able to navigate themselves around the moon. So we'll be taking strip photography, one photograph every 20 seconds on two separate revolutions, to try to tie the front side of the moon accurately all the way around to the back, wherever it's illuminated.
Mm-hmm.
Another photographic job will be at what we call targets of opportunity, where we keep our eye open for points of geologic, scientific interest, and try to get photographs of these. We have roughly 1,200 70-millimeter exposures available to us, and a goodly number of these will be taken in lunar orbit.
All in color?
Yes, some in color, some in black and white. Of course, the moon is mostly black and white, so using color film wouldn't help too much, but we should get some spectacular shots of the Earth in lunar orbit and, of course, between the Earth and the moon in color film.
We may expect to see quite a few of these when you get back.
Yes, and certainly you hope you'll see some good shots on black and white television.
Is it safe to say that the camera is taking the place of a lot of the navigation which would be used on an actual lunar landing as a training mechanism?
The camera will record the relative locations of various points on the surface, and by putting enough pictures together, hopefully we can determine exact locations. Now, knowing these locations, we can tie down what we call the lunar grid or the lunar map, then more accurately feed latitude and longitude of any particular point into our computer. This is, of course, for the next mission,
mm-hmm.
And thereby being able to determine better where we are in lunar orbit.
You will actually be getting some stereoscopic effects from your photography,
yes,
or mapping, won't you?
Yes, we'll have the second mapping pass, shooting one series of pictures on a 20-degree angle to the surface, and another pass where we'll be doing vertical shots, and by overlapping these, we'll have a stereoscopic effect.
Photography as a lunar mapper.
Right.
Thanks very much, Bill Anders.
You're welcome.
Just a moment.
Okay.
Rolling?
Everybody rolling?
Yes, sir.
Bill, we've already had a lot of photography from the moon with Lunar Orbiter and Surveyor, and there's been considerable discussion in many parts of the scientific community about instruments photographing the moon versus astronauts. How do you feel about that?
Well, certainly there are some tasks that instruments can do better than man. But we have strongly felt all along that there's a very important place for man in space.
to do the kind of jobs that instruments and computers have never been too well at doing. To be able to take in a lot of different factors, to be able to observe and integrate a whole scene that maybe a camera could do a better job in taking a specific picture of a specific point. But man would be able to assimilate a great amount of information concerning the lunar surface and possibly make some on-the-spot predictions of what might have gone on with time as to how this particular feature on the surface was formed. And I don't think a machine could do that as well.
Is it the difference between objectivity and subjectivity?
I think that puts it quite well, yes.
The man can be subjective?
Right. Mm-hmm. It's hard to program a computer to be subjective.
All right. Now, looking at it before you leave here at the Earth, what do you expect to see?
Well, we've studied the lunar orbiter maps, photos, very extensively, and have pinned down particular points of interest on the moon that we'll be looking for to try to unravel some of the lack of understanding and confusion that might be associated with any particular feature. So we're going to be looking for good, obvious signs of volcanic activity to try to determine what is of meteoritic nature, impact nature, and what is volcanic. To try to get a little bit of better handle on some of these what appear to be strange features on the moon.
You're using an engineer's term there, handle.
Right.
Understanding, you mean.
Right, to get a better understanding of just what has gone on the surface of the moon. And mm-hmm. I think in learning about the moon, we'll be able to unravel some of the mysteries of our planet, which have been covered up considerably by erosion. And we don't have at least water erosion on the moon.
Now, how much training have you had from the professional geologists and scientists in preparing you for these observations?
Well, all our crews have had a rather extensive course over the last several years in geology, particularly concentrating on volcanics and meteoritic impact studies. We've traveled essentially all over the world looking at features on the Earth which may have lunar analogs. We spend a lot of time in the classrooms studying these kind of things, and we feel like we have a pretty basic, good basic knowledge in what it would take to be a competent geologic observer on the moon.
Where are some of the places you've been to see these things?
We've been to Hawaii, Alaska, Iceland, Mexico, and of course all over the United States, which is a relatively active geologic region.
Mm-hmm. Mostly volcanic or meteoric.
Right, we've looked at a lot of volcanoes, and mm-hmm. they're frankly quite interesting.
You climbed around in them?
Yes, I've been all over them.
Do you think you can recognize that from 60 nautical miles?
That'll be difficult. We have seen some volcanoes, particularly those in Mexico, like the Pinacate area, which even right inside of it, it's really difficult to determine that is a volcano as opposed to a meteor crater.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the differences are very subtle.
All right, we'll be waiting for that subjective report when you get back.
Fine.
Thank you, Bill Anders.
Everybody rolling?
Bill, how are you going to find time to take pictures and continue to be the systems engineer?
Well, that's one of the dilemmas you get into in a business like this, that though there are some fascinating things going on outside the windows of the spacecraft, which I'm sure we'll have a hard time keeping our eyes off of all the time, the mundane things of spaceflight, just like on board ship, you always have to keep an eye on the boiler room to make sure that the systems are working.
You're going to go down in the basement and take a look every now and then.
Right. I'll have one eye out the window and one eye on the gauges.
Okay. We'll be listening to your reports while you're in lunar orbit. Okay, now the little philosophical thing.
Okay, this will be the subjective.
Okay. Bill, this is your first trip into space. You've been an astronaut for about 4 years. You've flown most of your life. What's the meaning of the program to you? How do you feel down inside about being a part of this whole thing?
Well, I've always felt that our space program, the Earth Orbital Program, but particularly the lunar program, has a great significance not just to our country, but to all the peoples of the world. I think that that this is something we can all get enthused about and possibly help us to forget our individual petty grievances between people, between nations. And I think as we depart the Earth and head on out towards the moon, the Earth becomes smaller and smaller, that not only will the continents blend together, but I think man's problems will hopefully blend together, and maybe we can sort of start things off with generating
a sort of a spirit of cooperation, and of course at Christmas time, a sort of a peace on earth, goodwill towards men aspect of this flight.
You're a member of the Catholic faith. I'm sure you're quite conscious of those around the world who are part of the same religion as you.
Yes, I think that not just for Catholics, but for all Christians and people of any faith, that this spirit of Christmas, so-called, and the spirit of space exploration is something that everyone can get involved with, and we hope they will.
Well, we hope that your Christmas is merry there in this most unusual fashion.
It certainly will be, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Bill Anders of Apollo 8.
Thank you, Red.